This is What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by Matthew Walland, ASP's Fellow for Public Diplomacy. Matthew, thanks for joining us.
Maggie, it's good to be here. Thank you.
And to be fair, you are actually here for every podcast. You are my tech guru counterpart, but now we have you on the other side of the microphone.
It's nice to not be sitting at the soundboard, although I've still managed to do that at the same time. So let's hope it goes well.
We're going
to
be great. So as ASP's Fellow for Public Diplomacy, I know one thing that's been on your mind lately a lot has been public diplomacy strategy and overall priorities for the next administration, right?
Maggie, that's right. There's a lot of things on the list, and it's a matter of prioritizing what we need to tackle first. And I'd say right off the top of the bat, we really need to look at appointing somebody who's going to be in charge of U.S. public diplomacy. The Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs at the Department of State is an incredibly important position. It's the military equivalent of a four-star general, basically. And for much of the time since this position has existed after USIA was folded into the State Department, starting in about 1999, the position's been unfilled about 30% of the time. It used to be worse, but with the undersecretary who's been in charge since the latter part of the Obama administration, that person has stayed in a position for a much longer period than previous undersecretaries have, by a factor of about another third. So I have a serious concern that this position could go unfilled for a long time, and I'm hoping the new administration will make this a priority.
Now, of course, you're talking about current Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, Richard Stengel, who,
correct,
of course, did his very first public appearance right here at ASP, which you moderated. And from that experience, you know, and looking at Undersecretary Stengel's track record, what are some things that you're hoping for from the next person to fill that role?
I'd like to see continued engagement along a number of fronts, and certainly I've written about how I hate the word engagement, although I'm using it right now, but it's really about building relationships. I'd like to see us try to continue some of the relationships that we've built up in the world over the past several years, and not forsake those, and this is something that I have concerned about, especially with regards to our allies. We want to make sure that we're maintaining those relationships, we're not letting them go by the wayside, that we're continuing to build relations with our NATO allies. And this is not just from a military standpoint, since public diplomacy is really about the people of a country. We want to make sure that the people in those countries understand what the United States is doing, understands the policies that it's taking, and understands that we value their opinions. It's going to be a critical part for making sure that they see value in themselves being part of partnerships with the United States, and in terms of moving forward on some of the initiatives that the new administration might take, might make a priority. Now, that being said, there's been a lot of focus in the last number of years on online engagement, that is, using the tools of the internet to build relationships overseas with foreign publics, to facilitate communication, to share ideas, and specifically to combat violent extremism. And I'm sure that will be a priority of the new administration, but it's a matter of finding out the most effective ways to do it. And online communication is a tool for this, but it's not necessarily the most effective platform that's out there.
So what would be a better alternative, do you think?
You know, online communication can be a great way to start. It puts you in contact with people that you might not normally be able to reach out to. I mean, we have to look at the size of the State Department and the size of public diplomacy in general. I mean, the State Department on its own, its entirety, has about 60,000 employees. And, you know, a certain portion of those are in the United States, a certain portion of those are overseas. But a number of years ago, when I was calculating the average size of staff for the U.S. embassies, it was about the size of your average, you know, maybe even less than a big box retail store. So when you're talking about addressing the needs of a country from a diplomatic standpoint, the amount of staff you have dedicated to that is rather minimal. So online tools give you the ability to expand what single staff can do, but we have to understand that it's both, it's not inexpensive, even though the internet and some of its tools might be considered free in some sense. It takes a lot of time, effort, and expertise to put together efforts to do that. If you want somebody to be working with foreign publics over Facebook or Twitter, that takes constant engagement. You can't just do it part of the time. It has to be all of the time. But we have to put something beyond just words and typing and interacting with people in that way. We actually have to build physical, real-world action. Things that happen on the internet don't actually happen. Unless you get into issues of cybersecurity,
like,
and that sort of thing.
Some sort of inception-based things, well, that happen on the internet don't actually happen. No, I mean, you're right, but man, does this mean this podcast is not actually happening?
Well, if you're listening to it, that's physical action, so let's hope that that's something. but you know, insert, yeah, sure, you can get down to the details where doing things like, you know, typing messages, yeah, that's physical action because you're actually undertaking an effort to do something, but that needs to translate into something that happens off of the internet. The end result can't be something that is electronic. It has to be something that's in the real world. So the real goal is to use the digital world to create analog actions. You know, if you want to encourage people in a foreign country to undertake a certain action, you can do that online. But if they don't actually take the actions in the real world to perhaps vote a certain way, and the United States tends to be rather hesitant about making those types of recommendations. But the purpose of public diplomacy is, in fact, to influence foreign publics. Or to use the information that we have learned from foreign publics to come up with better policies or better ways of tackling a certain policy in order to achieve what our actual objective is. So we have to look for those real-world results.
Okay, so let's talk about those real-world results. And I know, you know, you've just said, you know, talking about how an individual or group of people votes, not something the U.S. government likes to get into these days for good reason. But some other examples. Let's think about countering violent extremism, right?
Certainly.
That's not about getting somebody to vote a certain way, right? That, and some may make the argument it's not about getting a person to do something. It's about getting them not to do something.
Which is an incredibly difficult thing to measure. You know, we look at the rate of ISIS recruitment and that sort of thing. And every year it still seems like they have 30,000 foreign fighters in Iraq and Syria. And despite the numbers that we use to say how many we may have killed or wounded or how much we've destroyed, that number doesn't seem to change much, at least in terms of what we've seen being issued by the intelligence departments on or the intelligence community in terms of public records and that sort of thing. So, you know, measuring the choice to not do something is difficult. How do you do that? We can measure whether or not a recruit has decided to join ISIS, but we can't measure whether or not that potential recruit has decided not to.
Right.
So it's difficult, and one of the holy grails of public diplomacy per se is indeed measurement and metrics. How do you know what you're doing is working? I think one of the ways that we can measure this is how much people or how many people or to what degree they are actually working beyond those that are in governments to fight extremism online or maybe even in person. We have to look at the number of organizations that have stood up to fight this. We have to look at the amount of discourse that's taken place online. If we see more people arguing against insurgents, or terrorists per se, if we see more people forming, you know, online communities to fight this, you know, beyond what the U.S. is directly funding, then that might be one way to measure it, is the amount of pushback against this type of action online. But again, you know, it's a matter of deciding what metrics we need to use in order to decide whether or not we're achieving our policy. And that's something that we really need to think about at the very beginning before we start throwing spaghetti at the wall.
Okay, so far, you know, in terms of priorities for the next administration, we've talked about making sure that this four-star general of public diplomacy, if you will, that position is filled quickly and by someone who is capable and committed to building relationships. We've talked about the importance of measurement and metrics and figuring out, is your public diplomacy doing anything? What else? What's another, you know, kind of big picture priority?
I would say that given some of the discourse that we've seen over the election cycle and some of the concern that's been expressed by foreign publics overseas, we really need to clarify what the American message is. You know, the United States is, as many have called it in some previous presidents, you know, the shining beacon on the hill. And I think we want it to remain that way for a variety of reasons. We want to attract people to our ideas. We want to attract people to our business. If you look at some of the statistics on what foreign publics most admire about the United States, business is one of them. Mm-hmm. And that certainly benefits our new president. If we look at other issues, science is another one, science and technology. Culture can be viewed in a few different ways. You can measure it in what people think about it, which they sometimes might express a rejection to. But if you look at the consumption of, say, you know, Hollywood movies and American music, et cetera, then we're doing pretty well on that front.
Interesting.
Our education system is certainly viewed as something that's desirable by people around the world. I was just looking at the statistics a short while ago. There's over 20 million foreign students studying in the United States, at least with the latest numbers available for 2015.
Wow.
So that's significant.
Right.
But we need to decide, you know, as a country, what are these key things about America that we want to highlight? And I think adjusting rhetoric and making sure that we are not offending our allies is going to be key. And, you know, possibly even some of those countries that we might not have friendly relationships. If we go back to those student exchange numbers, Iran, at my last look, was ranked at number 11 of the top countries that send students to the United States. And sure, that might cause some consternation about people who might think, well, they come to the United States, they learn all of our stuff, they take it back to Iran and do bad things with it. But I think it goes beyond that, because those people who are coming here have to leave Iran in order to apply for it. And that's considerable.
Right. It's a significant burden to undertake. And perhaps, you know, you have people coming from Iran to learn here, to study here, and perhaps returning to Iran is not truly what they want, right? Given the many systems at play, I'm talking about immigration, visas, et cetera, you know, maybe they don't want to learn here and go back. They wouldn't like to stay, but then I guess they're not part of a foreign public and you get into a whole other mess.
You know, they certainly face a certain amount of risk when they do that, just as an American faces risk when they travel to Iran. I was reading earlier about the Iran-Iraq war and the period in which our relations with Iran were really dismal, especially, you know, after the
struggling.
after the Iranian hostage crisis. And a lot of the Iranian military that was trained in the U.S., you know, specifically on things like the F-14 Tomcat, were forced into early retirement or otherwise arrested, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, this goes beyond people who serve Iran. It's a risk. It's a risk that they take. And, you know, maybe some people choose to return and some people don't. And there's a variety of methods they might undertake to do that. But I think, you know, exposing people in countries like Iran to the United States is an important thing.
Okay, so just to recap one more time before we move on, somebody for Undersecretary of Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, making sure that we are clear about our metrics and our measurement tools, and we clarify America's message. These are three really big picture items. How do you think these three priorities, directly or indirectly, can and should and or might impact public diplomacy or general foreign policy outcomes on a specific issue? You know, how do you think if we can clarify and commit to an American message and figure out how we're going to measure our impact, and we have a kind of a strong governance structure, management mm-hmm. structure. What do you think the impact of that would be on something like our relations with Russia? You know, of course, ASP has recently launched a new program to really look closely at U.S.-Russia relations, and of course, you are leading that program. So I'm curious, you know, the overlap you see between public diplomacy and Russia.
This has been something that I've been thinking about quite a bit lately, and we face a number of challenges on this front, even if we do everything right, per se. The Russians have not been particularly cooperative in the public diplomacy sphere. Now, there's been a lot of concern over the last number of years that Russia's been doing a lot of international broadcasting through things like RT, formerly known as Russia Today, news outlets like, well, I shouldn't use the word news because it's really a propaganda outlet.
Every time we get an RT request, which we get quite a few of, I always love hearing your response because it's like equally as, I don't know, excited.
I'm more happy to help out a legitimate news source than something is explicitly a propaganda tool of the Russian government. Now, that being said, you know, there is information out there that's promoted by sources like RT or by Sputnik that's just completely false, and it's designed to erode people's trust in whatever the truth may be. And this is a general Russian policy. And in order to do that, they've taken two aspects. One is to flood people with information so that there's so many opposing stories out there that all contradict each other that people don't actually understand what the truth is. The second is to restrict certain types of information. Now, yes, you can access the internet in Russia and you can find most of the information that you want out there. But with so much of it, it's harder to do. And I think we're seeing that with our own social media outlets nowadays. We don't know what the truth is because there's so much opposing information. But the other thing that Russia's done is, like I was mentioning, in terms of restricting information, is they've made it so that the news outlets in Russia cannot be foreign-owned, essentially. So organizations that have more than, say, a 50% foreign ownership are not allowed to broadcast in Russia. So that has caused issues with our own international broadcasters run through the Broadcasting Board of Governors. So
just to back up to make sure I understand what you're saying. So does this mean that, I don't know.
Basically, what it boils down is to that Russia can broadcast Russia Today in the United States, but we can't use things like Voice of America or Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty in Russia.
And it can, let's say, I don't know,
It can be accessible online, but actual physical broadcasting is not possible.
In theory, obviously, you know, something like PBS not broadcasting in Russia, but if PBS, as something that is owned by, you know, foreign entities, non-Russia or government or non-Russians, are they allowed to broadcast?
If it is majority foreign-owned, no.
So it doesn't matter if it's government, individuals, companies. It's just as long as it's...
Based on my understanding of the laws in Russia, that's correct.
That's so interesting.
So that pretty much solidifies domestic control over the Russian media sphere. I mean, and there is just a little bit of independent media, you know, left in Russia. And I don't know if this is because it's token media per se or because they've actually been able to defend themselves well. But, I mean, you can subscribe to either view of that.
Interesting. Okay, so...
So the question is, you know, if we get it right or if we get it wrong. You know, this is a concern, especially in the near abroad for Russia, especially in areas like the Baltics and in areas like Moldova, where there are significant Russian-speaking populations or ethnic Russian populations. You know, we're worried a little bit about the little green men starting to appear again, as they have appeared in, you know, what we've discussed as the gray zone in previous podcasts. We're worried about that, and we don't really know if the Russians are being effective in the efforts that they're making towards these areas. Mm-hmm. We've talked a lot about doing stuff to oppose it, but we don't understand if it's effective, and if it's effective, who it's effective with, and why. Mm. There's been a little bit of research that I've seen coming out of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, but some of it seems to not quite make sense. Like that people who are very well educated are more likely to sympathize with what Russia has done in Ukraine than people who are not as educated.
This is the hardest thing about podcasts for me, is that no one can ever see my face when I'm listening to something that whoever I'm interviewing is talking about. And this is one of those cases. Okay, keep going.
So we look at issues like this and we start throwing spaghetti on the wall and we start creating from what I've seen looks like pretty decent production efforts to counter some of the Russian misinformation and the broadcasting efforts. But we just don't really have a full understanding, and we need to invest more time and effort into researching these audiences and then doing post-broadcast research essentially to find out what's happening with what we're doing. So I think that's going to be a really key, important issue. And we also want to do things like increasing exchanges in those areas. We want exposure, not only of people to the United States, but from people in the United States abroad. The numbers are shocking. Just in terms of worldwide numbers, you know, I mentioned the 20 million students that are studying in the United States. We've only got about 313,000 studying abroad.
Wow.
So the for what's supposed to be an exchange, it's embarrassing in a sense. We don't send enough Americans abroad. We don't understand the rest of the world. And if we're not sending people to the rest of the world, it makes people wonder what the value in the United States is. You know, if we don't care about them, why should they care about us? And this worries me quite a bit. So I think increasing exchanges into some of these Eastern European areas, into some of the Russian year abroad, increasing our diplomatic efforts in these areas, and having eyes on the ground, making relationships with the people in these countries so that we can have a better way to predict or at least analyze which way things might go if under certain scenarios.
Right. So not just eyes on the ground, really, but ears on the ground.
Absolutely. And let me put it this way. If we had a really solid amount of, I won't say, you know, intelligence on the ground, but if we had a sizable number of people on the ground in Iraq beforehand, if we spent more time with people who weren't from the expat community from Iraq beforehand, would we have made the same decisions that we made in 2003? Would we have had a better understanding of what the reactions to a U.S. invasion of that country would be, and whether or not it would lead to what we had envisioned?
Right.
Or different tacks that we could take. This is really important for contingency planning and for policy planning in general. We need to understand what is going on in these countries.
It's almost like, you know, I'm thinking back to my years of even pretty recently writing papers, right? And when you're doing research, your professors, your teachers, they always say, when appropriate and when available, rely on a primary source. Right?
Absolutely.
Why go second or third hand?
A primary source that has been there or is still there.
Right, someone with firsthand relevant information. And of course, you know, more information is not always better, but more better information is better.
And it doesn't have to be information about that government per se. Right. It's information about the people. Because when you look at it, when we put troops or diplomats into a country, the people that they are dealing with on the majority of the time is people
citizens.
Are on the ground. So,
yeah.
You know, the public diplomacy skills are incredibly important for the military. They're obviously important for the diplomats, but they're important for the country as a whole.
So, Matthew, our what's next question, I'm going to twist it a little bit and say, what's next in terms of figuring out how to do this right? Like, where do we turn our attention to now and going forward to improve upon our previous public diplomacy practices, et cetera? What's kind of that one thing?
I would say part of it is understanding the past and learning our mistakes. You know, in order to know what's next, we need to look at what has happened in the past.
Solid action.
To make sure that, you know, we don't repeat ourselves if it was a failure, or that we do repeat those good policies if it was a success. Now, we can look at the Cold War and we can get the public diplomacy situation right. We can let's just call it winning our current situation with Russia, where everybody's happy in the end. But the problem is we weren't paying close enough attention afterwards.
Mm.
And the situation that developed in Russia afterwards obviously has not turned out for the better. In terms of U.S. interests. We have a really good tendency to win the combat, and whether or not we want to frame public diplomacy in a combat sense of winning, you know, might not be the right thing to do, but we have goals and we need to be able to measure them. So, you know, if it goes well, it will because we have measured what we are trying to achieve. We've decided what we are trying to achieve, and we are using public diplomacy as a tool amongst many to accomplish this. If we fail to do this, or if we rely completely on public diplomacy to solve our problems abroad or explain America away, and we don't take the time to listen and truly understand. And that goes beyond just hearing what people say.
Sure.
That means truly understand and factoring that into the way we make decisions, then we're going to have a bigger problem on our hands than we have right now. And I don't think things are going to go well. But, you know, if we get it right and people are in communication with each other, we build better understanding, we build relationships, and we put value and time and effort into making people feel valued, that foreign publics feel like they're an important part of how the United States makes decisions and that their needs matter in this globalized world, whether we like it or not, that's going to be a key to success.
Well, Matthew Wallen, ASP's fellow for public diplomacy, thanks for joining us on this side of the microphone instead of at the soundboard.
Maggie, thanks very much.
This has been What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Filch.